all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Pretty exciting, wasn't it? We're racing down the hallway to get here. We're so excited to have you here on Veterans Radio today. We want to thank you very much for listening and tuning in here to Talk Radio 1600 in beautiful Ann Arbor. And we want to welcome you to our program this afternoon. We're going to be talking with our partner Jim Falzone in just a moment about what's going on with Legal Help for Veterans. And then a little bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking with Paul Schwimmer, who is part of the he does a lot of great things out there in the world, and he is part of the History Flight. And what the History Flight does is they go out and they recover the remains of servicemen and women basically around the world, mostly in the Pacific. But he just recently got back from Germany. He was on the program last week. Some of you who listened to our program, he was on Skype, and it got a little bit garbly, I think, and that's one of the reasons that I asked Paul to come back on the program. So we're going to continue moving along. First of all, I want to welcome everybody to the program, and to all our veteran brothers and sisters who went to war, we want to thank you for your service. For all of you that came home, welcome home. For those that didn't, we will never, ever forget you. And that's the name of the game here at Veterans Radio. That's our job, is to keep these stories going, to make sure that no one forgets any of the military people that have ever served. I mean, we're going back to the Revolutionary War and probably have to go find some of those if we could with Paul at some point. And that's the goal here at Veterans Radio. And we thank you and appreciate all of you listening to us every single week here. If you want to give us a call later on when Paul's on, I think you might be interested in what he has to say. And you can call us here at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600, or toll free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. I'm still catching my breath. I'm coming down the hallway. and joining me on the line right now is my partner and legal expert, and that is Jim Falzone. Jim.
Dale, good to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you. I was so excited talking in the green room before we came on the air that Derek had to come in and say, "Hey, you guys got to get going." Okay. Forgot.
So, it's reminding you to watch the clock.
Yes. Nina was over there pounding me on the back going, come on, let's go. So we you just got back from a conference in Las Vegas. And I guess let me remind people that you are the principal at Legal Help for Veterans, and that is your specialty, helping veterans with their claims, and especially after they've been denied the first time, you jump in there and go to Veterans Court and all those things, don't you?
Absolutely. At Legal Help for Veterans, we work on veterans' disability claims, and most of the folks we're working on are veterans who've been denied by the VA at the regional office and are moving up the administrative change, the ladder, if you will, to either the Board of Veterans Appeals, which is the highest administrative court, and then from there you can take it to a U.S. court in Washington, D.C. We're licensed to practice before that U.S. Court of Claims as well. We just came back from the National Organization of Veterans Advocate semi-annual meeting. This one was held at Vegas.
Oh, that's too bad.
Somebody's got to go, Dale. You know how that is.
I know.
This is a gathering, National Organization of Veterans Advocate, or NOVA, as we call it. NOVA's been around, now for, 2 decades, I think it is. Gathering of, attorneys and agents who work on veterans, disability claims. So it's sort of our bar association for this specialty. When I started in this, 15 years ago or so, you might be able to get 30 of us in the room. Now you can maybe get 300 of us in a room. But we go and hear what's going on from our fellow attorneys and agents about hot issues. And over the last 5 years or so, maybe a little more than that, we've gotten the respect of VA and gotten the respect of the courts, and we generally have one of the veteran court judges come and talk to us about hot issues before the court, and we generally have some high muckety-mucks from the VA disability side come and talk to the veterans about current issues.
Okay, so what was the primary message that you got at this year's conference or this biannual conference?
So what I think there's two areas that I'd like to, if I get a chance, to talk about. One is the backlog at the Board of Veterans Appeals. As I said, after your regional office, whether it's in St. Pete's or San Diego or Denver or Detroit, turns down your claim or your, whether that be a new claim for a new disability or an increased rating, you have the opportunity to go to a Board of Veterans Appeals. You can ask for a hearing before that board, and you can either go to Washington, which very few people do, or you can wait for a traveling board to come into your regional office and hear those claims. One of the things that we've heard over the last few years, and I think this is generally, you know, all our veterans know about the big backlog of new claims that the VA was processing.
Right.
And now they tell you, well, we've got that all under control. We've done so much better. What they don't tell you, the dirty little secret, is it has resulted in a huge backlog in claims on appeal before the Board of Veterans Appeals. Right now, there are 440,000 claims on appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals.
You said 440,000?
Yes.
Wow.
By their own admission, it will take them 4 or 5 years to work through the current backlog. If they didn't have any more coming in the line and they stopped to close the gates today, they'd clear that out in 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years. But in the meantime, there's going to be more people coming into the system.
Exactly. And the statistics they reported out to us, there are 80,000 of those claims that are greater than 5 years in the system. So this is where veterans get the view that sometimes they feel like VA is, you know, deny until you die.
Right. Yes.
If you're in that group of 440 on appeal right at the moment, and your advocate or your lawyer or your VSOs is telling you, geez, you're not going to hear anything for 4 or 5 years, you're there thinking, I don't know if I'm going to last that long. And if you're in that unfortunate group, you know, which is almost 20% of that crowd is greater than 5 years, you're really feeling the weight and the frustration and the concern that I might outlive this. So the way this works is, and you know, they said this statistics holds pretty much true. You know, they've looked at this for every 5 year increments. This is pretty much the case. About 10% of the new claims that get started end up in appeal status. So about 90% of the time, what they award people, they're happy with. But about 10% of the time, the award is either denied or it's not given the right rating or the effective date is wrong and you have to appeal it. That 10% has stayed pretty consistent over the decades.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And VA has told us in this meeting that they've now projected out what will happen over the next, you know, decade, if you will, if they don't fix the system. And they're expecting that they're going to see 2 million claims on appeal by 2027. Well, they can't handle 440. There's no way. They know there's no way the current system can handle the projected 2 million claims if that 10% number keeps working its way through. So this was a big issue at the conference. The VA had just the week before the conference called a meeting together of all the stakeholders, including VSOs and the attorneys and members of Congress to sort of say, we've done our analysis. While we've sort of fixed the new claim problem, our appeal process is broken and, you know, headed over the cliff. We've got to figure out what to do there because what we're doing presently is not sustainable.
Right. There's a lot of things all these politicians have to get behind and get to the VA and help them out. I don't know if it's more funding or just hiring more people.
Well, and that was discussed. We had one of the speakers was the Chief Counsel for Policy and Procedures of the Board of Veteran Appeals, Jim Ridgway. And he came in and candidly laid out the numbers and pointed out what their problems are and sort of said, I don't know that we can actually solve this with just more money and more people. VA is going to seek some changes in the law. One of the things that they proposed was simply eliminating hearings before the board. It takes up a lot of time that judges and staff could be doing other things with. So I anticipate current hearings will be eliminated. There'll be many people who think that's going in the wrong direction. It's going in a direction of less due process,
right,
less transparency. And a lot of guys just want to tell their story to somebody who they can look in the eye and know is listening. And if they get denied, they get denied.
Mm-hmm.
But at least now they know somebody actually heard the story. Oftentimes we feel we send in the information and nobody listens. But I think it's almost a given that board hearings will be eliminated as one of the possible ways to try to speed up the process.
Okay. You mentioned there was one other thing that you wanted to hit on.
Absolutely. One other thing that was pointed out to all of the advocates is that if you've been denied for a traumatic brain injury, there's a bubbling scandal at VA over who's been making those decisions. The rules are very clear that TBI has to be determined by certain specialist doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're finding across the nation as we've dug into this as veteran advocates is that doctors who aren't in those specialties, so unqualified doctors, and even nurses are giving the diagnosis that you don't have a mild or severe TBI. So you're going to hear a lot more about this as we go forward as veterans say, man, I think there's something wrong with me, but VA says there isn't. It may well turn out that you were misdiagnosed or not diagnosed by somebody who even VA says is unqualified because they're not in the specialties that the VA has identified.
Well, there's a lot of issues going on over there at the VA, and we got to keep our ear to the ground and see what's going on. I was just talking to somebody last week who has said that they've come up with this claim that they have a 13-week guaranteed cure for post-traumatic stress.
Oh, give me some information on that, because that and some snake oil I'll buy. So.
Okay, I will do that. I was talking to a guy at lunch last week because he said that some people have had their post-traumatic stress claims reviewed and they've been taken away from them. And I sure. This could be hearsay, obviously, but sometimes hearsay, at least half of it, there's some part of truth to it.
Yep,
and
yep,
so we've got to be looking into that. So, Jim, I know that you're doing a lot of podcasting now. I'll let you give a plug here for our podcast. So tell me where we can find some more stories.
Absolutely. I would encourage all of our listeners who want to hear more about veteran stories to go to veteransradio.net. Go up at the top. There's a 24/7 button. Click on that. It'll take you to our podcast where we have stories from folks such as Austin Statesman, in Texas, investigating opioid use by veterans. We've got discussions by professors out of Georgetown University on warrior culture and mental health. We have a great interview with General Ann Dunwoody, the first woman to become a four-star general, as she talks about her views on leadership and a book that she wrote, A Higher Standard. So we've got some really good stories about veterans. You want a tough guy? Go listen to Sergeant Mills talk about what he's gone through after being blown up by an IED in Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne. He lost all four limbs. But, man, this guy, who's actually from a little town up in the Thumb, Michigan, has got the best attitude of anyone you're ever going to meet. It's an inspiring story, and I encourage you to go listen to our podcast on veteransradio.net. Go to the 24/7 button, click on that, and you'll find these great stories.
That's us. Right. Good job, Jim. Thank you very much, and I'll be talking to you again with more things that are going on at the VA and how we can get these guys' claims handled quickly.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on, Dale.
Thanks, Jim, very much. I got one other issue I wanted to talk about before we take a quick break. This is for you local veterans here in Michigan. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but veterans in the state of Michigan with 100% disability, that means you can't work, you're unemployable. Right now, under current law, you are exempt from paying your property taxes to wherever you live in the state of Michigan, whatever county. And that could be, if you live in Ann Arbor, that could run, you know, for some people, that's $6,000-$8,000 a year. And so that is something that was passed recently. Well, I guess I can't say recent, a couple of years ago. But guess what? They're trying to change that. And so the House Bill 5169 wants to do away with the exemption for 100% disabled veterans and instead give them a $1,200 tax credit. Now, I can't do the math so much, but I'm going to ask some of you out there to try and figure this out. But there was a report that was done by, it's a legislative analysis called the Veteran Property Tax Benefit. You can go to the Michigan House, look under House Bill 5169, and it's listed there. And it says here that it would save the state, this is what I like the best, the bill would also increase the number of homestead property. It would save the state $16 million, and they would use that money for education, school for the aid fund, and so on and so forth. It would end up costing each veteran approximately $1,000 in exchange. So we don't think this is very good, and I would like you all to contact your local representative, and especially Earl Pulaski of Jackson. Representative Earl Pulaski, the guy who introduced this bill, and, you know, come on. What are you talking about? You know, we want to give the city of Detroit $700 million for their schools, and you want to take $12 million from a bunch of veterans? Come on. Anyway, that's just my rant for the morning. we're going to take a real quick break here because I want to get into with our guest right now, Paul Schwimmer, and we're going to be talking about rescuing, finding the remains of American servicemen all over the world. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. Andrew Sisters from the World War II era, and I think we had to use that music because I thought it was kind of appropriate for today's program. Joining me in the studio right now, and if you want, again, out there for you that are listening on your radio or on the internet, you can call us at 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600, or toll free at 844-838-1600. As I said, joining me in the studio is Paul Schwimmer. Paul is in his real life. He's a professional land surveyor, but he's gotten himself involved in an organization called History Flight. And what History Flight does, and I'm going to read this off of our flyer, is that it's a non-governmental organization dedicated to finding, recovering, and repatriating America's war dead to American soil. Over the last 10 years, History Flight has sent over 100 search and rescue teams all over the world to locate lost sites of missing servicemen and to recover them. They employ cutting-edge, multidisciplinary, remote sensing methodologies to find MIA lost sites. And this says that there are more than 500 American servicemen still missing. My guess is that the number is probably higher than that at some point. But anyway, Paul Schwimmer, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here again.
I want to remind our audience that we talked with Paul last week and when he was in Germany doing a recovery. And we were on Skype, and it got a little garbled, so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to ask him to come on in. So tell me a little bit about this History Flight. I mean, I gave a little background on it, but how did you get involved with these folks?
I started getting involved with the World War II boys when I was raising funds and participating in the Pride and Honor flights with Jack and Faye Wisely, just a phenomenal pair. And then I got invited to go overseas on my first mission, and I did so. And then when I came back, I was doing a history, I was doing a Pride and Honor flight, and I was pretty, I'll use the word mentally upset from what I had seen overseas in the recoveries. And as I was talking to an old World War II vet about it, he grabbed me by the arm, and he looked me in the eye, and he goes, God bless you, son. He says, you bring every one of those boys back home. And you don't have to tell me twice. And since that time, I've been overseas. I think it's over 15 times now. The personal reason I do it, or that I started to do it, I told myself was that if I was lost overseas, I wouldn't want somebody to come find me. We promised, the government promised that we would bring these boys home, and we're doing the best job that we can. Another reason that the team does it is for the family, for the closure of the family. People think, well, there's nobody left. Well, that's not the case. There are people left. And even if there's not direct relatives, we're finding that the youth are just fascinated by what we're finding of their relatives.
I think the idea of finding, you know, as you said, many times the parents of these servicemen obviously would have passed on their own. And now you're into, you know, nephews and nieces and so forth. And I think that, you know, they're always kind of fascinated about what their family did, especially, you know, the World War II generation. You know, I didn't know Uncle Joe very well. He was lost in, you know, the places that you have been. And you were able to kind of put an end to that chapter.
We put an end to that. We give closure. We're also going to talk about what the active duty guys think of what we're doing. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But there just came out an article of a Marine that fought on the island of Tarawa, and he decided that after 70 years of watching his best friend, Elmer Mathis, get killed right next to him, that he was going to find out what happened to Elmer. And so he contacted the Marine Corps, the Marine League, and it just so happened that History Flight had recovered. Well, we have a tentative, you know, identification of Elmer. And so for this older gentleman who's worried about this for 70 years, you know, it's closure. So let's take a minute and tell everybody, all the Marines out there that fought in World War II in the Pacific, we're still looking. And for those of you that fought on Tarawa, I want you to be at rest because we're finding those boys.
We're going to find them. We got about 5 minutes before we have to take a break at the bottom. Who is Jackie?
Oh, Jackie. During World War II in the European theater, we were fighting the Battle of the Bulge. The German army had made this offensive against us, and we were getting pretty severely pushed back because of the weather. The first day that the skies cleared, God bless America, man, she threw everything that would fly into the air to beat back the panzers, and 10 of our B-26 Marauders were taken down. 9 had been previously found, and in 2012, History Flight found the 10th one, and she was called the Unconscious. 2013, we took a team back, and we started an excavation, and when we found the first piece of human remains, we contacted the family. They were aware of what we were doing, and Jackie, the sister to the door gunner, got on an airplane at 85 years old, flew to Europe, flew to Belgium, drove to the site, found a priest, and she came to the excavation site because, in her words, this is as close to my brother as I'll ever be again in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So people care. You know, Americans care that we're bringing these kids home.
I think it is interesting. We've always been taught, and you were in the service yourself. We talked about this earlier. We're in special forces. You jump school and all these other different things. Is that we've always been taught that you never leave anybody behind. And whether it takes, in some cases, you know, a couple of days to go out and find these guys, or it takes 75 years to find them, it looks like we're still doing this.
You know, you started at the program that we're looking for everybody, World War II and then Vietnam. I did get an invitation a couple of months ago to go look for a Revolutionary War body.
Really?
So that may be an interesting, that'll be an interesting recovery if we get to do that this year.
That does it. I get into this stuff too. I just got this new book on all the presidents of America, and it's just fascinating when you read about all the adventures that those particular veterans did. You know, and many of them, of course, went on to become presidents of the United States and so on and so forth. And that they never, even though, I mean, Washington set the tone. He said, never, you know, you never leave anybody behind, and we always take care of our own. Because if we don't take care of our own, who will? And you're not going to get volunteers if we don't take care of them.
The number of MIAs from all the great wars, not great wars, of all the wars, it ranges between 73 and 83,000 missing boys.
That's why I thought the number of 500 was a little low.
500 could have been the ones that we're going after.
Okay.
On Tarawa.
Wow. That's a lot. Okay, we had about a minute to go till the break. Okay. So Jackie did that. What about, can you tell me a little bit about Manly Winkley?
Manly Winkley was a United States Marine, a young man who fought on the island of Tarawa. He was killed on the island. We worked with, at that time it was JPAC, the governmental agency. Now it's DPAA. They've changed their organization. They're absolutely wonderful to work with. We worked with them, and we recovered three United States Marines side by side in one hole. Manly Winkley, because of his dental features, and that's how we're doing a lot of the identification through the dental, very distinct dental, so the JPEC identified him very rapidly, and he was brought home to southern Indiana, Nashville, Indiana, and it's kind of a long story, so if you want to take a break now.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Paul Schwimmer here on Veterans Radio. You're invited. Come on back after the news. Back on Veterans Radio with our continuing. You like our singers this week? That's the Andrew Sisters. We like to, you know, last week we had an orchestra in here, so it's really gets kind of crowded in our control room every once in a while. We are talking with Paul Schwimmer, who is involved with the history flight, which goes out and recovers the remains of American servicemen and women. It also was involved with the Bent Prop Project, which did pretty much the same thing, it sounds like, and it's just kind of grown. I think it probably has grown since you've gotten involved in with it, hasn't it? The whole idea of going out looking for these people?
Not really. Not really. There's some major groups that are doing it. It's a difficult field to get into. In Ann Arbor, I sit on the board of directors for an organization called the A. Scott Foundation, who have very, very generously supported my activities. It is not inexpensive to do what we do.
I would think not.
But the A. Scott Foundation has been funding me, and they will continue to fund me, I hope. We're getting a little support from the government now. They finally started to come through with some funds, but there's three or four organizations that are of patriotic Americans that are doing what we're doing. I can tell you right now, it's here in the Eastern Time Zone. It's 5:35. The team in northern Germany that's working on the recovery of the pilot of the P-47 we talked about last week, it's about 10:47, so they're crashed. They're going to bed. They'll hit it again tomorrow. And on the island of Tarawa, it's 9:30 in the morning. And that team is in the field doing recoveries as we speak. So it's worldwide.
Well, tell me a little bit about, you know, we were talking about Manly Winkley, and you said that you found him based on his dental records, but there was a longer story to that. So let's kind of get into that.
Yeah, when we bought Manly Winkley home, you know, you don't think that Americans care. You know, you don't see it very often. But when down in Indiana, three of us from History Flight went to the funeral, and as soon as we drove into the funeral home, it was a magical time. They were interested in how we had found him and how it happened. And then when the procession of probably 50 cars left the funeral home, Dale, there was the American Legion was there, the VFW was there. We had 10 state police troopers on motorcycles. And we pulled out of the parking lot and we headed down toward this small town. And you could see the people lined up in the town, the American flags. Mm-hmm. They were three deep waiting to honor this World War II hero, and the procession stopped on the side of this big, long incline. And we were in the mountains, and I rolled down my window. It was peaceful and it was quiet, and all of a sudden, you heard the roar of a Harley-Davidson. You know, that deep throat of it.
Yeah.
And you're going, what is going on? And then 150 more. It just shattered the silence. Mm-hmm. And these patriotic riders came out two on two on two, 150 of them. And now our procession was approximately a quarter to a half mile long. And those guys led us for 66 miles to the National Cemetery in Madison. And it was the most incredible experience for those of us in the procession. People lined along the street, every intersection, Americans out there. People pulled off to the side of the road when we came through with their hands over the heart. You go through the cities and the fire departments were out with everybody in colors and the hook and ladders up with American flags suspended.
Wow.
It was incredible. And I held it up pretty good until we went through a very small town. And we went under the fire trucks with the flags, and you came around the corner, and there was a United States Marine.
Full uniform.
Full uniform. He had the horse with the saddle, with the stirrups in backwards.
Oh, my.
And that's where we lost it.
Sure.
You know, it was such an incredible experience to see Americanism in mm-hmm. full tilt in southern Indiana. And for us, it was just awe-lifting, you know, to see America at its finest. And so that was a great experience. Now, Manly's not the only one we bought home, but mm-hmm. a lot of them are like that. But Manly Winkley and that procession and that Marine standing there just, you know,
yeah.
It's a part of honor for me.
It took my breath away there.
It still takes mine away.
I can certainly understand that. Well, you had mentioned that you wanted to go to Wake Island. Now tell me about Wake Island.
Yeah, Wake Island is
I've been to Wake Island. On my way to Vietnam, I think I stopped there for about an hour.
Yep, there's not many of us there. There's about 100. There were about 150 residents on it at the time. The important thing about Wake Island is we were working for the Air Force doing some archaeological land surveying for them, and a flight of Marine F-18s came in with their tanker, and they landed, and the tanker got called away, so the five F-18s were stuck on the island. And the XO was an older gentleman, maybe in his late 30s, and then he had control of these four young pilots. And he and I started to talk, and we became very good friends over the next 3 weeks. And then let me just read this little story I have in my journal about our closing visit. And I labeled this, it's called The Promise, and it's VFM 323, and it's the Marine Fighter Attack Squadron of F-18 Hornets. And it goes like this. Major Mike, United States Marine Corps, and I just simply bonded when we first met one another. He was the officer in charge of five F-18 Jet fighters that got, quote-unquote, stranded on Wake Island when their Air Force KC-10 refueling tanker got called away. I liked him for his leadership of his young pilots, and he appreciated my searching for MIAs around the world. It didn't hurt that we both drank bourbon. Toward the end of this trip, and while at the Drifters Reef Pub, he looked at me in the eyes and said, "If I ever go down, I want you to come find me." I looked him in the eyes and promised I'd come get him. When departing last night, he again said, "Paul, I want you to come find me if I go down." "Mikey," I said, "I've got your back. I will bring you home." We clasped hands, told each other to be safe, and said goodbye. So the active duty guys want to know that we're going to come looking for them. And we will.
All right, so we've left Wake Island now with the Marines, and now you're going to go to Tarawa. And this is where you began, isn't it?
Tarawa, the Marines came in, and it was unfortunate they came in at low tide. They had to cross a quarter mile, and they pretty much got decimated. So let's start Tarawa with another little poem out of my journal. That I had copied, that a survivor had talked about the fierceness of the battle that the Marines fought against the Japanese entrenched. And it goes like this. He pointed to a Marine laying on the pier and asked, "You know who that is?" I said that I didn't. "It's the lieutenant," he said. "He's dead. The lieutenant was my best friend." And that's the way it was. Everyone's best friend was lying dead, sprawled on the beach, stiffened in the water, rocking with the tide as if in a cradle. As far as you could see, men floated in the terrible stiffness of death. They were Marines. They were our best men. They went in there with all that they had, and they came in, and they came in, and they came in. And those that came through took that damn island called Tarawa. And those are the boys that we're finding right now. Out of about 1,200 dead, we think there's probably 450 that are remained, that were lost. After the battle, the heat was so intensive that they used bulldozers to dig trenches, and they laid the Americans in the trenches, covered them up, and then, Dale, everybody left. And the Seabees came onto the island, and they wanted to improve the airstrip. So they raised the island about 18 inches to 3 feet and buried all the cemeteries. So they were, these boys were, you know, technically lost.
So how what is the process that you go through in trying to find these men?
It's research. Mark Noah, the president, CEO of History Flight, has been to Tara approximately over 30 times. He's done a lot of research. And based on his research, he has called in Cadaver Dog that specializes in recovery, sensing burials of that 70 years ago, and then ground-penetrating radar. I came in as a surveyor and did mapping, and we took the old photography. And based on that, we started excavating, and sure enough, we found our best find today is the trench in what we call Cemetery 27. It's a burial trench. Mm-hmm. I was naive enough to believe that the young Americans were wrapped in their ponchos and laid head to toe in this trench. And as we did the excavation, we found out that wasn't quite the case. They were just tossed in. It was expedient. There were 6,000 dead Japanese. There was 1,000 Americans, and they buried them. The team had found the trench. Mr. Noah had called me and asked me if I could come back to Tarawa to help with the excavation. And he says, "I'm sending you a picture, Paul." And he sent it, and I put up on my screen, and I looked at it, and I called my wife down, and I said, "Honey, I got to go." And she looked at the picture, and she goes, "Yeah, babe, you got to go." And 3 days later, I was back on Tarawa, and I helped on the recovery of number 16 through number 27 in that trench. And it turns out that number 22 was the Medal of Honor recipient, Lieutenant Bonneman. He just happened to be in there, but it's very moving. I made the mistake one time of we kind of had an idea who was going to be next, Dale, and I said, "I'd like to see the picture of him to know who we were covering." And if that kid was 15 years old staring at me in that picture, and it so you work in the trench, and I just had to get up once in a while, get out, take care of business, and then go back, and we'd recover the kid. But I didn't ask to look at the pictures anymore.
I wouldn't think so, because you look at them then. And, you know, they're all kids. And it's like when I was in it, when you were first in the service, too, we were all just kids. And we look a little different now, and I'm sure that when we go, when we pass away, we're going to look a lot different. And it's probably very disturbing, I would think. You also mentioned Kitabá. That's in the same area or the same?
That's the island group. Kitabá is the island group. And then Basio Island is where the Marines landed. They call it Tarawa or Tarawa. The Americans pronounce it Tarawa. The old Marines corrected me, a gentleman that came in a landing craft, and he goes, "No." He says it's pronounced Tarawa, sonny. And the way you remember that is the old song, Tarara Boom, yay. So the Marines, they came in. It's so sad on Tarawa because it's now the most densely – I believe it's the most densely populated single-structure island in the world. And it's not a very pleasant place to be. It's so sad that when you have to pay somebody to move their pigsty – and then you have to go down through that soup to get down to the good material, and then to go down looking for the kids after that. And no American in this world deserves to lie underneath that kind of filth and waste.
No,
so
no,
we're dedicated. When we go after these kids, we're pretty tunnel visioned.
It sounds like we need to take another break, Paul. I'm going to ask you to hold on. We're going to come back talking with Paul Schwimmer, and we're going to take a little trip to the north, I think, of where Tarawa is, or Tarara is, and to Vietnam, and see what he's been doing up to in Vietnam. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this brief message.
No one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and that, of course, was the Andrews Sisters again. And we're talking with Paul Schwimmer here, and Paul is involved with History Flight, which is an organization that sends teams out across the world to look for servicemen, mostly servicemen, I'm guessing, that were listed as MIA or were killed in action, and people just had to disappear over the time, and they never got home. And as we mentioned earlier in the program, at least here in America, we never leave anybody behind, never. So, Paul, I've got a little note here you wanted me to ask you about. Who is Jim Morrow?
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. On the island of Tarawa, in 2014, History Flight took six surviving Marines that had come ashore. Actually, only four made it in. Two had been shot coming in. And it was so incredible to see these 88 to 92-year-old men make this trip halfway around the world. They took them to New Zealand where they trained. They brought them over to the island. And at that time, we were excavating in what we called Cemetery 26. Well, Jim Morrow was at Cemetery 26. It was his guys that it was in.
Oh.
So during the day, the islanders very graciously treated these six Marines to festivities and honors and all that. But every day, those six Marines wanted to be back at that pit and wanted to watch us recover, you know, the remains in there. And we brought a priest out, and the song that I had read to you about Tara, well, we read that over the bodies. And one night we were at this hotel where we were staying, and Jim's very emotional. They all are. And he's got tears rolling down his eyes, and he's got me crying because I'm saying, Jim, I don't know what else I can do, you know. The interesting thing about that is that the guys were there, the six Marines were there, because we were turning over approximately 40 sets of remains, and they had bought in a C-130 Angel flight. And on that Angel flight, they bought in a second Marine Honor Guard, and those were the exact same division that our guys, six guys. And it was incredible that night to watch those young 22-year-old guys bond with their older brothers, these 88 to 92. The History Flight team just kind of melted to the back, Dale. And we just stood back and watched this magical moment. And then the next day we took the six Marines and we watched the Angel Flight, and they took those 40 kids back to Hawaii, took them back to American soil. Thanks for reminding me. Of those six boys, three have just passed. Jim was just one. Mm-hmm. We were on Tarawa a month ago when we got the word that he was failing. Yeah, and then he passed.
Mm-hmm. You think maybe it was his last wish, I guess, and that now that he had seen where his buddies were.
There was so much closure, yeah.
That I can go now.
Yeah, there was so there's so much peace and closure when we bring these kids home.
I can only imagine. My dad was on Iwo Jima in the Coast Guard, of all things, and he just kind of rode LST up onto the beach and stuff. And in Okinawa, his LST was hit by a kamikaze and went on fire and all this other stuff. And we just found these things. And there's an organization for this LST. And I've now communicated with the son of another guy that he knew and sent me pictures that I'd never seen and, you know, filled in all the gaps and stuff. And I think that's what we always need. It's like you were mentioning, you know, with Jim actually finding these buddies of his, and now he knows.
Now he knows.
And so he's at peace with that. You've also gone back to Vietnam. Tell me about that.
Yep, the A. Scott Foundation was interested in putting a team together to go investigate whether we could be efficient there. And we took a three-man team there, and we went to Da Nang. And then while I'm talking about Da Nang, let me just throw out to my brother George in Idaho, who's listening right now.
Hi, George.
George earned his combat infantry badge the hard way in the jungles of Vietnam with the 1st Air Cav. So love you, bro. Be safe. And then we took the team to Da Nang. We met with the we would call them the North Vietnamese regulars that had fought during the war at that time. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to work out a negotiation, and it was becoming successful where we would help them with our technology to find theirs. They were eager to help us find ours. We went to Da Nang. We went up to Thong Duc, which is a special forces camp where we knew one SF trooper is still missing. We went down to Cam Duc, another special forces camp where there's some Americans missing. And then we went down to Khe Sanh to explore that area. And while we were there, the Vietnamese had just recovered an American aircraft up deep in the mountains that we helped them identify. We feel it's an O2, one of the sky.
Oh, a bird dog.
Yep. Well, it's the push pull.
Yeah.
And so we're waiting for confirmation on that. JPAC or DPAA is doing a lot of their focus on the Vietnam, mm-hmm. and they're letting the NGOs us go after the World War II guys. I've been asked to put a team together or help fund a team to go back to Vietnam, and if we can raise the funds, we'll certainly do that.
Mm-hmm. Our former partner Gary Lilly went back to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And he said that it was closure for him as well. I mean, Gary had a lot of issues as a result of his service in Vietnam, but he had also run into a North Vietnamese soldier and took him back to where he was building runways and all that stuff because he was a CB. And he said it was just, he said it took his breath away. He said, that's the hill. He says, I knew it. He says, 50 years later, it's just, even though there was construction and everything else going on around it, he knew exactly where he was.
There's quite a few American vets going back for closure now.
Yeah. I see a lot of those in the magazines and so forth. You told us that, why you do this and how could people help out? If somebody wants to volunteer or to donate funding and so on, how can they help out?
Yeah, the best way to do it, like I say, I'm with the A. Scott Foundation, and then I volunteer for different teams. The History Flight is the real nuts and bolts of sending teams out, and the website is historyflight.com, historyflight.com, and they've got a really nice website. What we really need are our funds. It is not inexpensive. A fund of $5 will buy a 2-liter bottle of fresh water,
right, yeah.
because in Tarawa you can't drink the water, you can't do the ice. It's so bad there. So $15 will buy you a case. $1,600 will buy you the boat for the day. I was there a month ago. We were scanning the lagoon bottom for the landing craft that didn't make it in because we want to do an archaeological survey to see if the Americans are still down there. Very interesting fact, we came across a couple of tanks that were on the bottom.
Really?
So that was pretty interesting. It costs us about $8,000 a day to put a team into the field. Any contributions, the big corporations, if anybody is out there listening and you're looking for some way to be a part of history, because that's what it is, any money that you send us, you are now part of history. And finding these Americans, we would certainly appreciate it. And that's historyflight.com.
Historyflight.com. And I saw on their website that it said 96% of their funding goes
right back into the field.
Right
back into the field.
You know, that's pretty good return on your money. You talked about Tarawa. And we got about 4 minutes left. Could you describe the conditions there? I don't think our audience, I don't even know where it is. I'm trying to find it on the internet.
Yeah.
Where the heck is it?
I'm going to be polite.
We understand it's going to be a little primitive, but
if you want to see Tarawa, you want to type in Betio, B-E-T-I-O, Betio Island in Kitabas, and on World or Google Earth, and then that'll zoom you. Should be able to get you into the battlefield.
Okay.
Tarawa is. I have to be polite here. It's very hard to work in. There's a very primitive sanitation on the island. There's approximately 50,000 people crammed onto this island. In the area between houses, they'll have trash pits that they've dug. They'll have latrines that they dug. They'll have water holes that they'll dug. It's all within 15 feet. And we finally have introduced enough to these people that when they dig a hole, if they find bones, then they come and then they tell our local representative. When we drive around and we see a new hole or hole being dug, we'll stop. And I did that one time, and I go, any bones? And the native goes, no bones, just bombs. He goes, can you take the bombs to the bomb shelter, which is an old bunker? And I go, well, sure. And we put them on the floorboard of the car. The photographer we had wasn't really comfortable with me hitting the speed bumps.
Yeah.
But very hard to work in. You get sick easy there. I got dengue there. Some of the team members have got chikungunya. But we keep going back because that's where the American boys are.
It's hot and humid, I'm assuming.
Oh, it's hot, it's humid.
Is it right on the equator?
Terrible. It's you're so far south, you're 60 miles north of the equator, Dale. You can set your watch and it won't be off more than 4 minutes throughout the 4 years.
Wow.
I did pretty good eating last time I was there for 2 weeks. I only had intestinal problems twice, which I thought was pretty good.
I don't think I'll be volunteering for that particular journey.
I think C rations to show how old I am.
Yeah.
But no, we keep going. But things are getting better every time we go. It's just that it's unsanitary, it's dusty, and then you get this fungal chest infections. But we keep going back.
Well, you mentioned Tarawa. We got about two minutes to go. What other islands is History Flight going to other islands out there, or is this one of the main ones where they think they found the most?
This is where we're going to concentrate because we figure that we have a couple hundred more boys there yet.
Mm-hmm.
Cemetery 33, we worked into there. Unfortunately, after the war, the grave registration came into 33, and they found some of the trenches, and they just picked up the ponchos, and whatever was in the poncho, they recovered. Whatever was not, they left in the ground, and we were recovering that. And unfortunately, they threw all the litters in there, so it's kind of like working in a big, giant pack of pickup sticks, trying to weave around your body to recover these guys.
Were they mixed in with the Japanese?
In some cases, there are. PFC Allen, who we buried, I think there was four Japanese on top of him, and he was on the bottom. And so they recovered the four Japanese, and sure enough, there's an American on the bottom. When I left a month ago, there's another bunker they were doing. They have a Japanese officer, two swords on him, and then we think that there's an American there, too.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for being on the program. This stuff is fascinating to me and hopefully fascinating to our audience. We've been talking with Paul Schwimmer from the History Flight, and I encourage people to go to historyflight.org, make a nice little donation there, help these guys out. Runs about $8,000 a day just to get out there in the Pacific and make sure that we can find all these people. Because remember, in America, we never leave our servicemen behind, and so I want to make sure that you remember that. Never, ever do we leave them behind. And we'll be back next week here on Veterans Radio. Thank you for listening. It's our pleasure to always bring you these amazing stories. And until then, you are dismissed.